Well, welcome to our Cultural Engagement Chapel. This is our next to last one of the year. We're going to do one next week on Wednesday. Let me just tell you what we're going to do because it's a little bit unusual. Next Wednesday, we're going to be Skyping in Lee Strobel and interview him during chapel. So those of you who know about Lee and his work, you'll be, I think, interested in what we're going to discuss. He's going to talk about the state of apologetics in our time. So, and there are very few people who are more capable of speaking to that than he is. Up on the screen, you see the table podcasts, which is one thing that we talk about. That's why we have the table here, to highlight the podcast. But the big event that's coming up in a little over 2 weeks is the table conference. And at Bent Tree Fellowship, we have a special rate for students, $30 for the entire conference. Lee Strobel will lead us off in that conference, and then I'll be speaking on Friday night as well. And then we've got Dan Wallace and Craig Blomberg on Saturday, along with Michael Spiegel and Chuck Hill, to discuss which Jesus, which Bible, and which Christianity. How do you present God to those who see Christianity differently? And sort of in light of that, and what that represents today, I'm going to tackle a topic that comes up regularly that we aren't going to discuss directly at the conference. We'll be discussing other things related to it. And that has to do with what we would call the differences between the Gospels and the issues that that raises for people. Many people will play these differences off of one another. And as you can see, I have Dr. Hall Harris with me, a colleague in New Testament, who I affectionately refer to regularly as Dr. Google, because his reservoir of knowledge is vast, and you never quite know where his stream of thinking is going to go, but it always connects. We're going to discuss the issue of differences in the Gospels. This is an issue that I think most Christians struggle with in terms of knowing how to address when it comes up. And so I'm going to mention a few. We're going to have the mics open. You can ask questions yourselves, just to show the variety of things that go on. Because what some people will do is they will pit the Gospels against one another. Just want to see a show of hands. I'm going to run through a series of names, and I want to see how many of them you have heard of and you kind of know who they are. The first one is very famous. If I don't see a whole lot of hands here, I'll be really disappointed. Starting at right guard, Bart Ehrman. Okay, most of you have heard that name. Okay, you know he teaches New Testament and Christian studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. How about Marcus Borg? Is that a name some of you know? About half of you, okay. How about the name John Dominic Crossan? Okay, about half of you again. He's been all over television in the last decade or so, representing the historical Jesus. And what many of the names that I've just given, all of them teach at or have taught at major universities across the country. And what they often will do, will talk about the differences in the Gospels as a way of undercutting the kind of trust we can have in what they say. And the problem that you have here is that the differences that they point out between accounts are there. They exist. The question is, how do you explain them? How do you talk about them? Does difference equal contradiction, which is sometimes what you often hear, or does difference indicate something else? And so that's what I want to talk about with Hall. And I want to begin with a famous scene. The scene is the voice from heaven, okay? And at the baptism of Jesus, which doesn't exactly say the same thing at the same point of the conversation. And Hall, I'll let you introduce the problem for us. What are the differences, and where do they appear, and what's going on here?
Well, the major differences that really count in this discussion are going to be the actual words spoken by the voice from heaven. If we look at Luke's account and Mark's account, what we find is a second person singular statement, "You are my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased." And well and good, it sounds like that the voice from heaven comes and commends Jesus upon his baptism in the Jordan by John the Baptist. And for all we know, the words spoken by the voice are heard by Jesus himself there in the water, and perhaps overheard by John the Baptist, probably. But whether anybody else really hears them is sort of left open in the narrative. It's not really talked about. When we go over to Matthew's gospel, however, and we look at the same statement, what we have instead of "you are my beloved son," we find "this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." Now, the "you are" and "this is" are different in the original Greek, last I checked. And it looks like, you know, that unless we have a duplicate occurrence, which is fairly unlikely in this event, that Jesus got baptized by John the Baptist more than one time, then somehow the evangelists have come up with a slightly different rendition of what was said. And so, question one, what's the original statement likely to have been, and who changed it? And question two, why the change, which is often the case. And you can look at it from several different angles. I don't know if you want to go there yet, or no, if you just want me to introduce the problem.
Let's work on the problem a little bit. One of the things that's interesting is that in Mark, when we see the heavens split and the dove descending on Jesus, or one like a dove descending on Jesus, it's very, very clear that Jesus is the one who sees heaven split. It's very much a singular experience. You know, if you go into most museums around the world, particularly in Europe, where you have all kinds of medieval paintings and baptism scene by John the Baptist of Jesus, one of the most popular things painted in the medieval period, you will see, you know, a representation of the dove descending from heaven. You will see John the Baptist and Jesus. You will see a crowd around them. And the impression that you get is that everyone experienced this simultaneously. And so it's an important kind of distinction that's going on. It also raises questions for things that we're very used to, like how many of you own a red letter Bible? Okay, now look at those hands go up. Okay, so the question is, what are you going to put in red? And what you get in a lot of settings is you will see these differences pushed against one another as if they have to be competing kinds of understandings of the wording. So let's talk a little bit about the resolution of this one, or at least an explanation for a resolution. And Hall, how do you see this working, this passage, this difference between "this is my beloved son" and "you are my beloved son"? Now, some of you might say, well, isn't it possible that the voice said two things, "you are my beloved son" and "this is my beloved son"? That's one way to try and solve the problem. And I actually had a very famous conversation, well, not so famous, famous to me, with another prof at another school, in which we were discussing the reply, because this is like another problem, the confession of Peter at Caesarea Philippi, in which the answers come in different forms as well. You are the Christ, Mark. You are the Christ of God, Luke. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's Matthew, okay? So you get differences in what Peter says. And in having a conversation with this particular professor in exchange, this is an email exchange we were having as we were talking about these issues, his response was, well, Peter made all three confessions, one after another, and each gospel gave us one answer, to which my reply is, if that's going to be your answer, we probably don't have much to discuss. And so these differences are important in thinking through how the New Testament itself, how the Holy Spirit itself has inspired the text and what he's given us in the Gospels. So let's talk about both of these. First, the voice from heaven. How do you resolve that one, Hall?
Well, you can come at it from several different approaches. I was thinking about your Caesarea Philippi declaration. I thought to myself, Peter got interviewed three times at the end of John's Gospel. I don't know about this happening with the three synoptics all taken together. Seemed a bit odd. But anyway, you could say, if you hold a Markan priority, that the Markan account, "you are my beloved son," represents the closest to the original tradition and is picked up by Luke, and so Mark and Luke are sort of in agreement on that, and Matthew coming not first, if you hold a Mark in priority, has paraphrased for some reason or other the words to go from second person singular to more of a third person, more general statement. By the way, if you hold a Matthean priority, you can still say pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just that Matthew did the paraphrasing before Mark or Luke reverted to the original statement. And this gets into questions of literary dependency. When you talk about the motivation for why this might have happened, the answer that that often comes up is that we're moving from more of a private event witnessed by Jesus himself and presumably John the Baptist. By the way, why do I include John? Well, I happen to be a person who works with the Gospel of John a lot, and I know that's not popular in historical Jesus studies. We won't go there. But in John's Gospel, we have this big, long explanation of John the Baptist explaining that he received, I guess prophetically, prior revelation that the one on whom you see the Spirit descending and remaining, he's the one. And so John sees the dove, which is for him a sign of messianic identification of Jesus as the promised one.
So he apparently witnessed
the Messiah. So he apparently witnessed the descending dove. Presumably he would have therefore also been close enough to overhear the voice from heaven, unless you think it's some kind of an internal supernatural voice that was in Jesus' mind and nobody else outside could have heard it.
Dr. Google is doing wonderfully here. This is wonderfully stream of consciousness in terms of what's going on in the mind of the person.
That's right.
Let me.
But yeah, well, wait a minute. Let me finish here. I'm just getting started. Short answers. I know. I remember. I was
practicing him before we did this.
Short answers.
I needed short answers, which he apparently interprets as 6,000 words or less. But go ahead.
Hey. Compared to 40,000, 6,000 is short.
That's right. Yeah.
And no, the other side of it, though, is to say that what we have is we've moved to a more generalized paraphrase in Matthew's account because we want to portray the setting as more of a public setting, so that what we've got is instead of just a private word between the Father and the Son, with John the Baptist eavesdropping, we have more of a public declaration going on.
And the public declaration, this is really important, whereas you have the private experience that says, "You are my beloved Son," in Mark and Luke, what you're getting in Matthew is the declaration of the significance of this event for everybody, including the readers. And so this has been paraphrased into, "This is my beloved Son." This is a moment in which God was affirming who Jesus was, and Matthew's bringing that out in the shift. Now, here's the important point. In that shift, you are being as historical, but operating at a different level of historical significance than when you're reporting the speech. I can look at history from a variety of angles. In class, when we talk about this, we do a class together on the Gospels, and we talk about how many of you have heard of the Great War? Okay, now the Great War is actually a way to refer to World War I. But you don't call it World War I until you have World War II. So you're talking about the same thing, it's the same content, but the angle, the perspective at which you're looking at, the historical frame at which you're looking through is different. And so it's producing a different name for the same phenomenon. This is similar, okay? On the one hand, the intent is to portray exactly what was said. On the other, the intent is to portray the significance of what it means for that to have been said. And so you can't do it, "Well, this and you are my beloved Son." That's sloppy. So what you do is you make a choice. The difference at Caesarea Philippi is very, very similar. You are the Christ, you are the Christ of God. Well, that one doesn't give anyone too much trouble. They're virtually the same thing. One's longer than the other. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, that has some interesting implications in terms of where that can go, depending on how you relate Christ to Son of God. What some people will do is say, "Well, Christ is Messiah, but Son of God is Son of God." Okay, so we're going to a different place. But if you work with the Old Testament, you'll see that Messiah and Son of God can very much be related to one another. In the Davidic covenant, the God promises that he will treat the Davidic line, I will be to him as a father, he will be to me as a son. So there's an ambiguity there, which the text can play off of, which Matthew also can play off of, and I think that's what he's doing, that allows that confession to have an open-ended character to it that can be developed in light of what Jesus is going to do in the rest of his ministry. Now, those are both long and complex explanations, because sometimes it's easier to point out the nature of the difference than it is to work through how the difference works. But let me go through a couple of others, and then the mics are open. As you have questions, feel free to come up and we'll take them as they come. Here's the next one that I want to talk about. This is a very famous difference. In the healing of the centurion's son's slave, we get two very different ways in which this event is presented. And again, I'll let Hall summarize the difference in how this works. What's the difference in the healing of the centurion's son?
Well, the major difference in that section is that in one of the accounts, you get the centurion basically coming to Jesus and speaking directly in person.
That's
Matthew. And in the other one, which is Luke. Right? Thank you for the precision.
Yeah.
In the other one, Luke, we actually have the presence of intermediaries. So if you look at Luke's account only, it doesn't look as if the centurion goes to Jesus in person. He sends representatives, and the representatives are elders or leaders within the Jewish community. And so these Jewish community leaders, that's kind of odd right there, by the way, because you presume the centurion, being Roman, unless he's an auxiliary, mm-hmm. is not Jewish, mm-hmm. he's Gentile. Whereas, on the other hand, the emissaries which he sends are influential people from the Jewish community.
In fact, we know that the centurion is some kind of a Gentile, because at the end of the passage we're told, I haven't seen such faith like this in Israel.
Correct. Exactly. And so when Jesus is receiving the embassy, the delegation of the Jewish leaders on behalf of the centurion, the Jewish leaders say to Jesus, this man is worthy for you to do this for him because he's done a lot for us. He's kind of underwritten our synagogue. He's paying, he's contributing, he's helping, he's very much a friend of the Jewish community, so you ought to do this. Now, what do we have here? Do we have theological embellishment so that, you know, the brief, bare-bones Matthean account is the original, without the emissaries, and Luke has come along and he's inserted some characters.
He wants reconciliation.
Into the narrative because he's big on this Jewish-Gentile reconciliation, and so he wants to make it plain. Or, on the other hand, do you have, if you look at it from the opposite perspective, Luke is giving us the actual historical account with the emissaries, and what Matthew has done is he simply streamlined the account, condensed it based on the ancient principle that ambassadors or representatives can legally speak for the person they represent, so that when you talk to the representatives, you are de facto, in a legal sense, talking to the person who sent the representatives. And so we have some literary shortening, condensing, streamlining going on the one hand, whereas we have the longer, fuller version in Luke. I just want to point out, and you can go with this where you want from here, but I want to point out those two explanations are not completely reciprocal when we think about something like the problem of adding fictional secondary characters to the narrative, because one account involves the addition of fictional secondary characters, namely Luke, the emissaries. The other account, Matthew, simply involves shortening and condensing and omission. In other words, it's an issue of selectivity, what Matthew chooses to put in versus what he chooses to leave out.
So it makes a difference in this particular case which you choose.
Right.
In this case, the Shaliach principle, the sent one principle, the idea that someone can speak for someone else and represent them directly is probably in play. We actually do this today. You know, I tell people, how many of you know the name of the press secretary at the White House who actually gets up and gives the daily briefings? You don't care about that person because they are who they are. You care about that person because they're the press secretary and the little sign White House hangs over their head telling you who's speaking and that they represent the president, and that's why it's news. So we actually have principles like this today where a spokesperson can represent someone else. And this idea of condensing is not unusual for Matthew. In another very famous account that has a detail that often bothers people, when we get the double miracle, the woman of the healing with the hemorrhage along with the raising of Jairus' daughter, in the accounts, there's a very different way in which these are told. In Mark and in Luke, we get the full detail, many, many, many verses, about 16, I believe. And midway through the story, the daughter dies as Jesus is interacting with the woman who he's just healed of the condition of bleeding. But in Matthew, again, because of the condensing of the story, because of the condensing of the story, it's told with the girl being dead from the very beginning of the telling. Because for Matthew, what counts is not the sequence and the detail. For Matthew, what counts is by the time Jesus gets to the girl, she's quite dead. And so it's a different way, again, of selectivity of telling these stories. Now, you might say, well, what's the big deal? And the big deal is this, that what a lot of people will do is they will press these differences. They'll say, see, these gospel accounts don't really agree with one another. You can't work with them. You can't trust what they say. It's a way of undercutting what's going on in Scripture by playing these details against one another. Let me give you a bigger one. And this is the last example I want to use. And then I do want to open it up to the floor for questions. This is a famous one. This one appeared in a book written by Bart Ehrman called Jesus Interrupted, in which he was discussing these differences. And the difference that he made was between Mark's word on the cross, citing Psalm 22:1, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" The cry from the cross. And the other is what Luke does, citing Psalm 31:5, "Into your hands I commit my spirit," a word of trust. Now, listen to what Bart did with this passage. He says, you see, Mark's picture of the crucifixion and Luke's picture of the crucifixion and how Jesus reacts to it are night and day different. Mark has a troubled Jesus who cries out to God and who is going through a painful experience on the cross. And so he cries out, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" He's an abandoned Jesus. That's the one picture. Against that, and you can't put it together, against that is the picture in Luke. "Into your hands I commit my spirit." Here is a trusting Jesus. This is a Jesus who is relying on the Father. He's not despairing at all. In fact, if you read the entirety of Luke's gospel, he seems to be pretty in control of what's going on all the way through, much like Jesus is in the gospel of John when he goes through the crucifixion. So we've moved from a very human, despairing Jesus facing the shadow of death and almost shaking in his boots as he faces death over to this trusting, calm, serene figure who trusts in God. And you can't put those two together. And on the surface, if you read the one account versus the other account, and you see those differences, you go, you know, that looks sort of plausible. I could see, and Mark doesn't have, "Into your hands I commit my spirit." He doesn't have anything like that. And Luke doesn't have anything like, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" And of course, what we do as Christians and as Bible readers is we put them side by side and we don't have a problem with it, and so it doesn't bother us. But for someone who's saying, what can I do with this account in singularity and that account with singularity, it can raise an issue. So what do you do with that one? Because that's an interesting one. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the... I like Paul Harvey. You like Paul Harvey?
Yeah.
And Paul Harvey's little motto was, you know, whenever he turned...
The rest of the story.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So here's the rest of the story. If you read through Mark carefully, and a lot of these differences, the way to work through them is to read through the text carefully. you will come to a point at which Jesus cries out a second time. But Mark doesn't tell you what he says. Now, if you use something like a synopsis to read carefully, which has the columns of the various gospels next to one another and lays it out so you can see the sequence, what's interesting is that Matthew doesn't have Jesus cry out at the point at which Mark has Jesus cry out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But when you line up the column, when you come to the point where Mark says, Jesus cried out a second time, but doesn't tell you what he said, what Luke has is, into your hands I commit my spirit. In other words, Luke is filling in or completing a gap in Mark's story and is telling us what goes at that point. And the only way you would see it is to lay those two accounts next to one another to show that that's how the gap works. Now, that's another kind of difference. Let me go through a couple more real quick since I don't see anyone standing up, which is okay. Let's go through another one. What about the order of the temptations? Okay, we're not talking about the singing group. Okay, all right. So what about the order of the temptations? What are we dealing with there?
I just got culturally disengaged. That's outside my frame of reference.
Something right. Dr. Google does not know. Anyway, there'll be time to explain it to you later. Anyway,
know about it. But
you
I
know about the
don't
temptation.
Prefer to date myself.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, basically, you have three temptations in the wilderness in Matthew 4 and in Luke 4. And the three temptations are pretty much the same temptations. The only difference being that temptation number 2 and temptation number 3 are flipped or reversed between Matthew and Luke, so that Matthew ends with stones to bread and Luke ends with jump off the pinnacle of the
temple. Jerusalem.
Yeah, so you know, the question then becomes, well, how many times was Jesus really tempted here? 4, 5, 6? I mean, the first one's a duplicate, so you don't really need to deal with that, but you probably got to have 5 anyway to have the same. I mean, you've got to have repeats.
If you're going to maintain the sequence in both
simultaneously without acknowledging that one or the other looks like they have moved the order around.
Now, do you really want to go there?
Do I?
Do you really want to go there? Is that the answer, do you think, to that particular difference?
What?
That there were two sequences and there were 4 or 5. Is that really?
Well, how likely is that? I mean, it's like, why would you want to?
Okay, so what's the other option?
The other option is that one of them's been moved around. Okay. By one or the other of the evangelists for some reason.
And the reason might be that perhaps chronology is not as important as the fact that these did happen?
Well, that I don't know if that's the reason for moving them around, but it certainly opens up the possibility that they have been moved around. I mean, let's stop and just ask this question for a minute. We assume that the Gospels are in some sense or other chronological arrangements. I mean, after all, the two of the Gospels that have an infancy narrative put it at the front end, fairly logical, and all of the Gospels with their Passion Week, arrest, trials, crucifixion, burial, resurrection, except maybe for Mark if you take the short ending, they all put all that stuff at the back end. It's everything that goes in between the birth and the death in the public ministry that's kind of up for grabs. Why would we assume that the Gospels are intending to tell us a chronological account or sequence of events?
At least always.
On every occasion.
Yeah.
Why would we think that?
See, so what you have with the temptations, I'm going to give another example as well, because these examples can be multiplied, is with the temptations, the suggestion often is that Matthew has given us the original order. He has the tighter time markers between the temptations. He has Satan dismissed at the end. But with regard to Luke, Luke has switched the order because Jerusalem's going to be very, very important geographically to Luke's gospel. You're going to have a journey to Jerusalem in the middle, and that's come at the end. Let me give you another example of the same kind of thing, of rearrange. I'll give you two. The Nazareth synagogue speech of Jesus is smack in the middle of Matthew. It's in Matthew 13. Right. It's in Mark 6, which is close to the middle of Mark, but it's the first event coming out of the chute in the Galilean ministry in Luke 4. What's interesting is that in Luke 4, Jesus said to Jesus, do here what you did in Capernaum. Well, if you've read the narrative in Luke very, very carefully, Jesus hasn't gotten to Capernaum yet. He hasn't even ministered there. In fact, he's going to minister Capernaum in the next event after the synagogue speech. So it looks like Luke has brought this synagogue speech forward because it is paradigmatic. It marks out and typifies what Jesus' Galilean ministry is going to be like. And so that's more important than chronology. Or another example, in Mark chapter 2, verse 1 through 3, 5, you get five consecutive controversies back to back, nothing between them. Those same five controversies occupy the space of Matthew 8 to 12 in Matthew's gospel, with things in between, that break up some of the sequence. So it looks like what Mark has done is to topically present five quick controversies. This is the kind of stuff that got Jesus into trouble, and I'm going to tell you right off the kind of stuff that got Jesus into trouble. And then you get this other things on the backside. So that's the it's amazing how we've just skimmed the surface here. I see people standing up to ask questions, so go ahead, step forward.
Just thinking about how I often hear this explained from the pulpit, and usually I hear it explained as kind of the differences come from a personal journalistic perspective, just as, you know, we had tons of reporters at the Vatican talking about the Pope being elected, and they're obviously not all saying the exact same words and explaining it the exact same way. But I guess my concern sometimes in that being an explanation is sometimes there are journalistic differences that are actually errors. So for instance, the New York Times had to correct something this last weekend talking about Easter Sunday, Christians were going to gather together and celebrate the resurrection of Jesus into heaven. And that's obviously a journalistic error. And so I'm wondering, I guess I'm just wondering your thoughts on that line of reasoning and specifically how it would relate to us upholding inerrancy in Scripture. Do you think it's too simplistic, maybe even lazy?
Well, I think the issue actually of the journalist is not the problem as much as it is thinking through the way in which history works. And history can work with a variety of angles. I'm going to use an illustration because I think this makes the point vividly. We've been working with instant replay now in sports for several decades. There was a time when sporting events did not have instant replay, and Hall and I are old enough to remember those days. Some of you are so young, you've been living with instant replay from the moment you were born. In fact, your birth was instant replay. So think about instant replay for a second, and think about the importance of angle. How many of you would want to have instant replay and only have one camera angle? Wouldn't work on a lot of plays. The advantage of having many angles in an instant replay is that between the variety of angles, you can get a better look at what actually happened. You get multiple perspectives. This is popular today, particularly in thinking about literature and that kind of thing. Get multiple perspectives. So the idea, the problem with the journalist model can be that there's only one way to tell the story and there's only one angle on the story. Well, in fact, there can be multiple angles on the story. Let me give you a quick example of one that's almost shocking that's in the Gospels. When Jesus walks on the water in Mark, the story resolves itself at the end by saying, basically, the disciples didn't get it. They were hard of heart. When you get to the same event in Matthew and you come to the end, it says they bowed down and worshiped him as the Son of God. Now, you couldn't get two more distinct endings on the same event. You're talking about the same event. You're in the same place in both Gospels. You can't play this is the same miracle done twice in two different settings. That won't work. So you're dealing with the same event and you're dealing with the point of the conclusion. But the difference isn't that we're not dealing with a journalistic account or people aren't reporting. It's that they're reporting out of different concerns, out of different angles. Mark's reporting from the standpoint of, why didn't they get this? Why didn't they appreciate it when it was happening? Well, they didn't appreciate why it was happening because they were hard of heart. They just didn't get it. They weren't expecting this kind of thing out of Jesus yet. They were growing in their understanding of who he was. But Matthew's looking at it from the completely different angle. What impact did this event have on them? How did they come to appreciate the event, to use a good NFL phrase, upon further review? Okay? And looking back, it led them, as they contemplated what it meant about who Jesus was and his ability to walk on the water, what that showed about his control over the creation is, this one must be the Son of God. So that's what we're trying to do, and the reason we're doing this chapel and getting you to think about this is because it's in the opening up of the angles of the way history works that you don't look to flatten out the story, that you let each version of the story speak and each camera angle on the story speak. And it helps you to open up to what the possibilities are. Next question. Oh, look, over here. I always alternate. Over here.
I was just really confused.
I can hear you. Go ahead.
About Passover and whether the Last Supper was the Passover meal. Because as far as my studies have shown me, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have Jesus eating Passover.
That's correct.
And John has him the night before.
That's correct.
And if you think about it, though, the Passover meal starts the Sabbath, and so they wouldn't have been crucifying anybody on the Sabbath, or at least John of Arimathea wouldn't have been rushing to take him down before the Sabbath, because it would have been on the Sabbath.
I love a simple question. Yeah. Okay? This is actually one of the most famous examples that comes up. If you actually watch television over Easter week, And the show is done by someone who's more skeptical, they will inevitably point to this difference between the Passover, Jesus eating a Passover meal and Jesus being crucified on Passover day. So I've got a Johannine expert over, and it's John that creates the problem. So I'm gonna let our Johannine expert tackle this one, and then I'll back up with synoptic support.
Yeah, for those of you sitting in the back, the question was the portrayal of the Last Supper as a Passover meal in the synoptic Gospels versus something else in the Gospel of John, because Jesus is actually dying in the Gospel of John on the eve of the Passover, the day of preparation for the Passover, at approximately the time that the Passover lambs are being slain in the temple by the priest and their assistants, thereby having Jesus die as the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. At the very time the Passover lambs are being slain.
I love the way you answer a question.
Now, no, I'm just repeating the question because there were hands in the back.
Can
because
I repeat
people
the
couldn't
question?
Hear the
Can
question.
Can I try and repeat the question?
Yeah, sure.
Do the synoptics and John agree on the timing of Jesus' death?
not really.
Okay, go for it. Now, how do we resolve and work with this difference?
Well, actually, this is one of the worst things to deal with. I've seen accounts that try to have different time reckonings. The days start at sunup versus they start at sundown. The most popular explanation seems to be that Jesus, in celebrating the meal in the Synoptic Gospels, that appears to be a Passover, is following some kind of different Passover calculation calendrically than Jesus in the Gospel of John. In other words, John's giving us official Passover in the Jerusalem environs with the official celebration in the temple, and the Synoptic Gospels are giving us something of a private Passover celebrated by Jesus and his disciples. And there's been a lot of give and take done on this for about the last 50 years. The problem is that there's gaps in our knowledge. We have evidence for the existence of alternative calendars at places like Qumran and other places, Proving that a Galilean rabbi would have used such an alternative calendar is kind of a leap in the dark. It's very difficult. You have to assume that there's a reason going on for this. People point out other problems too, like where would Jesus have had his disciples obtain an official, quote unquote, Passover lamb several days before the official Passover, and would have any priest in the temple have been willing to consecrate a special lamb for somebody?
So let me take a different shot at this.
Yeah.
Okay?
Go ahead.
Okay, because that sounds way too complicated.
Oh, believe me. Okay. I haven't even scratched the surface.
How many of you celebrate Christmas parties at your offices on December 25th? Okay? Almost nobody. You see, the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread ran into one another.
Yeah.
They overlap. They have sacrifices attached to both sets of holidays that run through that schedule. And in Judaism, and you can see this in Josephus, in Judaism, you can call the entire 8 days Passover or Unleavened Bread.
Right.
You can go either way. So the point is, I think, that you can have the beginning of the Passover, Jesus taking a Passover meal with the Passover lamb, and you can have Jesus die with Passover and Passover lamb, because you're in the Passover, now watch this, season. You're in the season of the Passover. And so the whole thing is covered by the shadow of the presence of the Passover and the symbolism of the Passover. That's a very, again, a simpler at one level explanation. It's one that reflects commonly what we do at a popular level. We need to remember the Gospels are popular kinds of literature. And so my answer to this particular problem is that we're simply dealing with the fact that the Passover season is not just a specific day in people's minds, but it runs into the Unleavened Bread, and you're into the same kind of feast time, you're into the same kinds of demands for cleanliness, etc.
Yeah, but I think for that to work, you would still pretty much, if you're going to maintain any degree of real historicity for John's account, have to say that John's giving us official Passover.
Mm-hmm.
Because he goes to such lengths. He talks about the Jewish leadership, you know, basically wanting to have this crucifixion done and over with before the Passover. And when they go to Pilate to try to get the death sentence, they don't want to go into Pilate's residence, the praetorium, because they don't want to enter a Gentile dwelling and defile themselves, so they can't eat the Passover.
Mm-hmm. But to the extent that the cleanliness requirements extend through the entirety of the week.
Well, depends on what you mean by eating the Passover.
That's
though.
Right.
That's the bottom line.
So,
I think this one's one of those really hard ones that we're going to not resolve.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, one more question.
What do you do with the different resurrection accounts where in Matthew there's one angel sitting outside the tomb on the stone, in Mark there's the young man in the tomb, Luke has two angels standing, and then John doesn't even make a mention of the angels?
It's a good question, and again, it's another one that often comes up in these discussions. There's actually a lot of things that are going on between the resurrection accounts. The issue of one and two is another thing that we see in several places.
Right.
We have the healing of a blind man in Mark. But we have the healing of two blind men in the same location in Matthew. We have Jesus riding in on a donkey on the triumphal or a triumphal entry, depending on how you look at it. But in Matthew, the picture is that there were two animals that came in with Jesus at the same time, whereas Mark and Luke only highlight the one animal. So the differences between one and two are differences that we often see between the Gospels. And again, I think the issue here of simplifying the story oftentimes may be at play. There are other more interesting things actually happening between the resurrection accounts that make them very, very complicated, particularly the understanding of Mary Magdalene when she comes to understand that Jesus has appeared to her. In John, there's the appearing, she runs, she doesn't seem to know what's happened, she reports on it. Then later we get a scene where Jesus reveals himself, whereas in the synoptic she seems to understand from the very beginning what's going on. I have a peculiar way to deal with this one, and that is I think that in John, We're getting the story of how John experienced the resurrection to start off with, and he doesn't hang around for the whole story from the women before he runs off to the tomb. As soon as the women show up to report on the empty tomb, he's off and out the door along with Peter to check out what's happened, and they make a race to the tomb, and we find out that John wins the gold medal. And so he gets there first. And so we don't get the full report of what the women understand in John, so we've got to go back and collect that detail, and John retells that after he's done it. We've got a literary reordering, in other words, of the actual sequence of events that makes the issue somewhat more confusing. But the differences are real. I tell you what we're not used to. We're not used to the idea that in the ancient world, when they told and retold stories, they generally didn't tell them exactly the same way. And how do I know this? The Bible tells me so. Look at the retelling of the story of the appearance of Jesus to Paul on the Damascus Road. Told three different times in Acts 9, in Acts 22, in Acts 26. And every telling is different. And I've got the same author writing all three of those passages. So that tells me something about the way in which stories were told and presented in the ancient world. Now, we're going to talk more about this when we talk about the dimension of orality versus recording in the ancient world at the table conference. Unfortunately, our time is out, so how's that for a tease? So come to the table conference where we'll deal with a whole lot of these other issues over a couple of days. But we hope that this has been a good initial introduction into these kinds of areas. Some of these problems are very, very difficult, as with the case with the Passover, as we've mentioned. We want to be honest about the nature of the problems. But on the other hand, many of them are actually quite resolvable, and there aren't as many problematic ones as people often leave the impression. I think that's important to appreciate as well. So we thank you for coming, and we hope you have a great day. Thanks.